I will touch briefly on the passage that show that the words that are right before chapter 8. If you are using an NIV Bible, it will say something to the effect of the earliest and most reliable manuscripts and other ancient witnesses do not have John chapter 7 verse 53 through John chapter 8 verse 11. If you are using a King James Version, you will have nothing written there. The King James Version was based upon the Latin Vulgate written by a guy named Jerome, who was using these texts that did not include, or, I'm sorry, that automatically included that. And so when you read a King James Version, it was basing everything really on one major manuscript. They're called codices. So one major codex had this passage in it. That's why if you're reading King James, you'll never see it. That was done in 1611 when the King James Version came out. Since that time, lots and lots and lots of other manuscripts and codices have been discovered. Two of the major ones, Codex Alexandrius and Vaticanus, there's three of them, Alexandrius, Vaticanus, and Sinaiticus. Those showed up that did not include those, did not include this section, the story of the woman caught in adultery. That's why the NIV shows it there. Now, this brings up a really major question. What should we do with this information? Well, it's actually really easy in my mind. Every scholar agrees this isn't original, but every scholar also agrees that it is canonical, that it is something that should be a part of the Bible. It has been accepted by the church for thousands and thousands of years, and there's no problem. Now, I'll give you some of the stuff just so you know it. Yes, Amy. Some people think Luke wrote it. Some people think it was just a later insertion. Some people believe there's a body of material that the synoptics, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke drew on, and this story was in there as well. But it is interesting, John only is the only one that brings up this story. Now, this fits in well with John. Now, granted, it may not be John's writing, but it fits in great with John's theology, because John has this habit of story, discourse. And that's what's happening. Remember with the feeding of the 5,000? John is the only one, after mentioning the feeding of the 5,000, that launches into the bread of life discourse, the sermon that Jesus preached afterwards. So it fits beautifully into that plan. Also, I think there could have been some people in religious circles that don't like this story. And that's what happened. It was two major churches in the early church were growing up, the East and the West. The East hated this story. And it's not in any of the Eastern churches or in the Eastern fathers. The West loved the story. It was used by Jerome and Ambrose and Chrysostom and Augustine. All of them used it. Now, eight of the earliest codexes don't show this story, but two of those manuscripts leave a blank. There's a blank section. Does that tell you that maybe something was there and it's been sucked out of there? That's what it seems like. In the East, when the early church fathers wrote, they said that two crimes were the most heinous and did not merit any forgiveness, murder and adultery. Which tells you, can you have this story in here? You can't have this story if you're preaching against adultery in that fashion. So I believe, I wrote a ton of notes. It was used in the West. Oh, Jerome, when he wrote the Latin Vulgate, said that he found it in a ton of the early codices that we don't have anymore. So he says he was writing off of actual documents that had it. That lends support to it. It's in the Latin Vulgate. Eusebius and the Syriac Didascalon Apostolorum make allusions to it. They talk about, don't you remember when the people brought the woman to Jesus and he did not condemn her? Well, which story is that? This is the only one that's there! So, you know, they're making allusions to it. East was prejudiced against it. And again, as I said, eight early codices don't have it, but two of them leave blanks for it. So, all this is to say it's very reliable, it's a story that fits, it's a story that we can learn from and grow from, and the church has accepted it throughout the years. So, with that said, I'm going to treat it as if this is the Word of God and this is something that we need to study. I'm going to read the story and then I will comment on it. What was that? My sister. A prophet is not without honor in his own hometown. I am a prophet. Did you see what happened last week? What did I say? Last week, what did I say? I said that there was going to be a lawsuit and they were going to sue to take out the phrase "In God We Trust." What happened Monday morning? It was filed. Ooh! Just kidding. I just thought I'd bring that up because I'm, you know. That was amazing. I was shocked when I saw the news. I'm like, didn't I just say that? Yeah. All right. Anyway, we're moving on. Verse 53 of chapter 7, it's connected with this. Then each went to his own home. Chapter 8, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write in the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." There is so much in this story that if you were in the early church, yes, we'll cover that. Yeah, this stuff has so much in there that we might miss it because we're not really well versed in the Old Testament. There is so many things that we can discover about this passage that will enlighten it greatly. First question: how old was she? You don't know, do you? We can deduce that one. We can deduce that one because stoning was something that was reserved for very, very serious crimes. It was reserved for blasphemy. It was reserved for a very specific form of adultery. Also, if you had a cow that kept killing people, you're supposed to kill the cow, and if you knew about it, they would kill you too by stoning. Now, that's a serious crime. Mad cow disease. There's other crimes, but stoning was reserved for very serious things. Now, there is a whole litany of things about adultery that simply say you kill them, and that's it. It doesn't give the prescription of stoning. There is only one instance, and one instance only, in the form of adultery that requires stoning, which tells us that's the one that's being applied in this case. Where is that pulled from? Deuteronomy chapter 22, starting at verse 22. If a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. Doesn't say stoning yet, right? Hold on. You must purge the evil from Israel. Here it goes. If a man happens to meet in a town a virgin pledged to be married, and he sleeps with her, you shall take both of them to the gate of that town and stone them to death. The girl, because she was in a town and did not scream for help, and the man, because he violated another man's wife, you must purge the evil from among you. Okay, hold on a second. Go on, go back one there, Richard. How old was she? 12. Between 12 and 12 and a half. Anything under 12, you're a minor, could not be punished with capital punishment. If you were 12 and a half, you were already married. That's kind of a shocker. I know, that rubs us, doesn't it? 12-year-old girl. So when it says woman, it's really a female. You know, Jesus talks, it's a term of respect. Because in that culture, she actually was a woman. Remember, back in those days, engagement was tantamount to marriage. If you were engaged and you broke off the engagement, that was a divorce. If you're engaged with someone and someone if your partner dies, you are now called a widow. So this is a very important thing. Now, right now, tons of questions should be popping in your head about this thing, because the law also prescribed in Deuteronomy chapter 17 for the death penalty: on the testimony of two or three witnesses, a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. So, this crime can only be punished if two or three people saw the actual event. Now, I didn't research this one, but I heard someone say it, and it sounds right. I'm going to need to go and research it. I just tell you that because, you know, I like to verify all my facts. Someone was quoting an early church rabbi, Jewish rabbi, that said that this punishment, this crime could only be punished once every 7 years because of the lack of, I mean, how often do you get caught in adultery with two people watching? Yeah, if you're there and the husband walks in, that's not enough for a death sentence. He can divorce you, but you can't be killed for it. Now, some more things start coming in. So that means two or three. Now, how often did two people show up early in the morning at your house? This is a trap. This was set up completely and totally. Did the woman actually commit the crime? I believe so. I also believe the husband was in on it. That's speculation. I can't prove that. But how else are you going to have two of your friends standing outside? And where is the guy? Also, where is the guy that she was having the relationship with? Because the law clearly and unequivocally states both of them die. And also, why did Jesus? Is he the ruling council? He's not the Sanhedrin. Why are they bringing it to him? Also, they're having a problem because the punishment of capital punishment, the crime of capital punishment, was not able to be enforced because Rome had taken that away from the Jewish people. They couldn't stone him even if they wanted to. I mean, there's just a lot of things. This thing stinks to high heaven. It is entrapment. They trapped the girl, and they're going to do anything. They are willing to risk the life of a 12-year-old girl in order to get Jesus. You're starting to see some of the motivations. I mean, this is not just some simple little story. The man could be any age. He could be anywhere from 15 to 30 years old. Yeah, they usually don't say that. No, I don't think it was like a 70-year-old man. No, that's that weird Mormon cult. Where is that thing with the father that, oh man, that one's freaky. And he got like 20 wives and he's like 70 years old and, you know, that's nasty. I saw it on a Dateline. Anyway. I know, ADD, I'm sorry, I'm moving on. So, she was caught in the act. Is she guilty? You bet. You bet. They nabbed her. I think that the guy that had the relationship with her was in on the whole thing, which is why he's not there. That'd be the only explanation. The only explanation, yeah. Please.
See when you read Deuteronomy, that seems to imply if this woman was raped, out, she would be stoned along with the man that raped her.
Yeah, and that's the text. The idea is, was it consensual?
Yeah.
If it wasn't consensual, all she had to do was yell out and she was protected. And because remember, this is in the town. Again, if it happens out in the woods, there's total other rules that are set up. But yeah, that's the reason why they put up the benchmark of, did you cry for help? If you didn't cry for help, it must have been consensual. So, yeah. It is. It's a total setup. Any way you look at it. These guys are playing with people's lives. So they do this, and they're using this, remember, as a trap for Jesus. They were verse 6, they were using this question as a trap. Why would this be a trap? Real simple. If he said, let her go, he's violating the law. If he says, kill her, all of his disciples are going to start leaving because all of his disciples had problems too. Tax collectors, prostitutes, sinners. So what's going to happen? So he bends down and he starts to write on the ground with his finger. What did he write? Easy answer, we have no idea. But it's fun speculating, so let's do that. Because I was really shocked why did it mention his finger? Why not a stick? I mean, why didn't it just say that he bent down and started writing in the dust? Why did his finger get mentioned? I don't know. These are the dumb things that pastors think of, you know, in the middle of the night when they're studying things. So I decided to do a quick little study. And I looked up the phrase. Yes? Please. Tasia. Go ahead. Yeah, I'll give some more speculation, and that is a good speculation of exactly what it is that he wrote. We'll get to that in a moment. I said I'll cover it. You'll hear it. No, I'm just. Yeah, I know. I might forget. She'll remind me. Her theology professor at Lutheran High speculated that it was the names of the people who had committed sins, And that's what he was writing on the ground, the names and the sins that they committed. I have, that could be right, but I have a different theory, but I'll get to that in just a moment. So this finger of God. Now, does this phrase finger of God, first of all, it shows up in Luke 11, and Jesus applies that directly to himself. But if I drive out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of God has come on you. So he's equating finger of God, power, stuff like that. It shows up in Exodus chapter 8 with the magicians and the whole miracles that are taking place in the plagues. They come to the conclusion that this is the finger of God. So this is something that's real, real important. And again, this word finger doesn't show up. It shows up as just like a finger, or in this phraseology of finger of God, it shows up in one other context, shows up in two places, the same context. Exodus 31, when the Lord finished speaking to Moses on Mount Sinai, he gave him the two tablets of the testimony, the tablets of stone inscribed by the finger of God. Shows up again in Deuteronomy, the Lord gave me two stone tablets inscribed by the finger of God. On them were written the commandments. It's a theory. It's probably wrong. What happens is, because did Jesus have access to these stone tablets? Not as a traveling rabbi, but he probably knew what they looked like. What if as he was writing them, it was the exact same handwriting, the exact same strokes as was on those tablets because it was the finger of God? That's probably wrong. But you like that one, don't you? Yeah! That's what I say. I like that theory. Here's another theory, because it says that they keep on questioning him. So he's doing this while he's writing. Yeah, hold on to Jeremiah 17. Oh, yeah, let's do this one too. It could just be their names. And it all starts tying together. If they started picking up, maybe this is why the older ones left first. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you will be put to shame. Those who turn away from you, you will be written in the dust because they have forsaken the Lord, the spring of living water. Do you see how that all ties everything? They're going to be, they have forsaken him. They're being put to shame. They're all turning around and walking away. They're turning away. They're written in the dust. And what is this living water? What did we just cover in chapter 7? Jesus, good. Anyone who comes to me will have springs of living water. Anyone who comes to me will not thirst again. That's a good idea. Maybe he just started writing Jeremiah 17. Here's my theory. This is the one I like the most. Because he says this phrase, if anyone of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. That seems like an awfully hard benchmark. I mean, would any of us be able to? You know, there's an alternate translation. You ready? If any one of you is without that particular sin, let him be the first to cast a stone. Could it be, Tasia, that he started writing down the names of the guys and exactly what females they slept with? It's all speculation. I'm probably wrong. It's all speculation. And it's fun. I loved reading all these ideas of what did he actually write. We have no clue. But whatever he wrote caused the older ones to go away first, maybe because they did it most. Remember, if this crime cannot be proven, you have almost license to do whatever you wanted, and you can't get caught strong enough to be executed. I mean, what happens if we had that type of system? We wouldn't be able to convict anybody. If you had to have two eyewitnesses give exacting accounts, no deviation. Which tree were you under? That one. Oh, sorry, the other guy said that one. You're acquitted. That's how fast it happened. I tell you, that's what he might have been writing. I don't know. But whatever it was, they started walking away. And so then they go, and the older ones go first, and he's left with the woman. Now, it kind of gives the idea that he's there alone with her, and it's probably not true, because what was he doing? He was at the synagogue, and he was teaching. So a crowd had gathered around him and was listening to him when all of a sudden barged in on, and this took place. And it says specifically the accusers were the ones that went home. So you know what would have been interesting? What would happen if the accusers stayed to listen? You know, we do that sometimes. We get caught in certain things, and We don't stick around to hear the word of forgiveness. We're also taught that you need to identify with the characters. I tell you, I could not identify with any of these characters. You know why? Because none of them quite fit. Now, if the girl had said, no, wait a second. Where's the guy? It's not my fault. He's also to blame. Where's he? Now that's someone I can identify with, because every time I get caught in something, what do? Excuses start happening fast and furious. My father-in-law tells this great story. He was driving down the freeway, and he was going a little fast. And up ahead, there was an accident, and people were slamming on the brakes. And he realized, I cannot hit the brakes fast enough. I'm going to hit this car. So he's hitting the brakes, and he goes off the side of the shoulder. Now, the person behind him was also traveling really fast, started watching this truck go that way, and bam, hits the car. Guess who she sues? My father-in-law. Because if he hadn't turned out of the way, then she wouldn't have gotten in it. Isn't that fascinating? Don't we all do that? Something happens, and what do? Oh, I could come up with a lot. I slip into Walmart. They must have just waxed it. Maybe someone spilled a little water. How come they didn't clean that up? I'm going to sue. Oh, yeah, we're really good at taking things. That's why I like this lady. Sorry, this girl. 12-year-old. That's why. What does she do? Doesn't make any defense. She knows full well she's caught. She's not going to make any excuses whatsoever. Man, I try that. That has got to be the hardest thing to ever do. She is a prime example of exactly how we should be treating our sin. Don't make excuses. God don't want to hear it. You are culpable. You did it. But Jesus does this masterful stroke, because if he wouldn't have done anything, what would we do with sin? We'd just let it go. But what does he do? He says, go now and leave your life of sin. Boy, that's hard. See, I'm also like the religious people. Remember, this wasn't just some night lynching that was taking place. These were the religious, this would be the pastors. The pastors brought her. They were the ones. And I often find myself with stones in my hands because I'm fast and I'm accurate. I can hit pretty good. We got a call to put down the stones. Does that mean we turn a blind eye to sin? No. That's the tension. I tell you, that's got to be some of the hardest things that I ever do in terms of counseling. How do you not hammer the sinner so much that they lose all hope, but how do you still do things to make sure they know that what they're doing is wrong? And I tell you, I think we as humans will never be able to, we'll always slip one way or the other. We'll either be too quick to throw the stone, or will be too easy to turn a blind eye to a sin. God has something on us. He was Jesus. He was God in the flesh. He could pull this thing off. For us, it's a little bit harder. For us, it's a little bit more difficult. Who do you identify with? Now, I know that there's some people that identify with the girl. Man, I've been caught dead to rights. Phew. I have messed up royally, and people have hit me with rocks like you would not believe. Don't sit there and make justification. Own up to it. Yep, I messed up. Time to move on. Hear the word of forgiveness. I don't condemn you. That's how you try and get together God's justice with God's mercy. You know, we talk about John 3:16. What again happened to John 3:17? For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. That's hard. That'll be the hardest stuff you will ever encounter. Because you'll have an uncle, an aunt, a friend caught in a sin, and you're going to either throw the rocks too fast or you're going to announce the word of grace too fast. How hard that is. And that calls for wisdom, and that's why we trust. That's why I believe this story is so crucial. Oh, you know what? I also didn't say this. Jesus broke protocol because he was without sin, cast the first stone. Actually, the hands of the witnesses must be the first in putting him to death, and then the hands of all the people. So he broke protocol because the people that caught this woman in sin was supposed to be the first one to throw the stone. And again, that's why, stop a moment, put down the rock, think just a moment, before you act like that, because that's tough. We're playing with people's lives here, and that can be very, very dangerous. All right, enough with the story. Let's keep moving on. It's a great story. You know, we could dissect that all day, and there's still even more in there that I'm sure I missed. But, man, that word, that last phrase, go now and leave your life. I wonder what happened to her. What did she do after that? You know, I'm real curious. Did she become a leader in the church? I don't know. Did she become a great evangelist? I get the idea that Jesus probably did things in such a way that this was exactly the thing she needed to hear. And for some of you, that's exactly what you need to hear. God's not here to condemn you, but he doesn't want you to stay where you're at anymore. Max Lucado said it the best. God loves you just the way you are, but he loves you too much to leave you where you are. Okay, sorry, here we go. Verse 12. This next section ties in beautifully with the Feast of Tabernacles that I spoke of before. Remember, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths, centered around two major motifs: water and light. Every candle in the temple was lit, and they also had another special thing. During that day, with the water ceremony, also they would set up these huge, giant pillars, and they would put ladders against these pillars, and they would put four very large bowls of oil, and these large, they were the undergarments of the priest, would serve as the wicks. So we're not talking like they put little tea lights up on these things. It was like Olympic size, you know, there's four of them on each pillar, 16 lights total. It was huge. And it was, like I told you before, it was a festival. It was a Thanksgiving. I think I've read more and more evidence that that's what the early pilgrims used for Thanksgiving. I believe it's based on this feast. I talked to someone who said, yeah, they talked to a Jewish person, and it's tied in. I read it in my men's study. It has that in there. I'm like, holy cow, all these things that are pointing, that's, it's a festival. It's a time of Thanksgiving. They talked about one rabbi who could juggle 8 torches. It's a party. Now, I could juggle 3, sometimes 4, but I'm not the greatest. I mean, this was a party. And again, Jesus, right in the middle. I love it. It's probably dark. The light's probably being spread out all over. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this festival, out comes this voice. Jesus spoke again to the people. He said, I am the light of the world. That's ego e me again. He says it 7 times. He actually says it a bunch more times, but he's making a statement of who he is. Ego e me. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Did you miss the word? I did the first time I read it. You know what it doesn't say? It does not say, whoever receives me will never walk in darkness. What does it say? Whoever follows me. This is a tie-in back again to the Old Testament. They're wandering through the wilderness. Here they are leaving Egypt, and out comes this big old giant pillar that's all fire. And the idea was, if the pillar moves, you go with it, right? It's a plain and simple fact. Now, I don't know, maybe it happened, it happens today. People get the light and they go, oh my gosh, this is where I received the light. I'm going to sit down here and I'm going to put a little shrine and a little altar and I'm going to sing some songs. I'm going to do it all right here. And lo and behold, the light moves. Now, if the light moves, you're now in darkness. I know this is, I'm getting back into the eternal security question. Are you once saved, always saved? Or can you have the light, and then the light move, and you not get it? This is, I think, again, that whole indictment that Jesus is saying. The light has moved, and you're not following it. There comes a point with obedience and following that we do it. Again, receiving that is all by grace. It's all his wonderful gift. We didn't make the light appear. It shone on us. But then the light's going to start going. And wherever you're at, you need to follow. It's easy to sit down and not do anything. And I've seen too many people do that. They receive God with all earnestness and joy. So it's a parable of the sower, and then things start happening in their life and they just get burnt. No, if the light moves, time to pick up and start going. Yes, Amy. Oh, yeah, what's up? Are you not listening to my sermon? You're looking up other passages? No, I'm just kidding, Amy. Go ahead. Deuteronomy what? Yeah, there's some other, yeah, there are other crimes of stoning, but remember, stoning was reserved for very limited things. So that was the point of that, yeah. Too many people receive the light and then don't follow. To love God is to obey His commandments. I know we don't like to talk about that in churches, do we? But I think it's so crucial. I don't ever, ever want to be a church that just brings in people to faith. Now, I want to do that. Please, don't get me wrong. When people come to faith, it is wonderful. But my friends, that is not the purpose of the church. I was sickened every time I would go to a conference and there'd be these church planters. And, oh, we're just here to seek and save the lost. Oh, we just love the non-Christian. We want them to come in faith. And I'm like, I'm going to puke if I hear you say that one more time. I agree. Yes, we should be doing that. But that's receiving the light. And we've got to follow it. That's why we were very purposeful 4.5 years ago. Seek, connect, and guide this generation into an active relationship with God. I can seek you out and I can connect you, but I haven't done a thing if you're not then following, if you're not being guided into a fuller relationship with God. Because that's what it's about. Love and devotion and worship of God. Purpose of the church. Said it a million times, I'll say it a million and one. That's huge. So this is an important thing for all of us too. If you are that girl that has not received any love, any mercy, anything from anyone else, and you receive that from God today, that is just the beginning. And now there comes a time you leave the life of sin and you start moving on with it. You start doing it. There's no five-step program. I can't give you any, 10 steps to breaking through from spiritual darkness. I got Jesus saying, go and sin no more. Oh, brilliant. Thanks, Jesus. Where's my 3-point outline with A, B, C subpoints? No. You do it. Don't think about it. Don't debate it. Don't write down pros and cons. If God says something, you just do it. Watch what happens. Whoever follows will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So the Pharisees challenged him. They go back to an old argument, which always happens every time I get into arguments with religious people. They always go back to the same argument. They do the same thing. Here you are appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid. Huh? We're back to the 2 or 3 witness testimony thing. Listen to what Jesus answered. Even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid, for I know where I came from and where I'm going. I.e., I'm God. My testimony is valid. That's to say, yeah, if you want to boil that down. Yeah. But you have no idea where I come from or where I am going. I.e., you're a human. You judge by human standards. I pass judgment on no one, but if I do judge, my decisions are right because I am not alone. I stand with the Father who sent me. In your own law, it is written that the testimony of 2 men is valid. I am one who testifies for myself. My other witness is the Father who sent me. And yeah. My other witness is God himself, and I'm God, and so we got double witness going on here. And remember before he talked about John the Baptist witness to me, my own miracles testify on my behalf. Jesus has so much evidence, it's pathetic, but he still has to bring it all up because they don't buy it. Then they asked him, where is your father? That seems like a simple question, doesn't it? Come on now, who was Jesus' father? Was it Joseph? Hey, Jesus, I heard that, which also brings up an interesting point about Mary. How old was she? About 12, 13. And was she engaged? And then was she found to be with child? Do you need any witnesses there, people? There's one witness growing up inside of you that says you have messed up the betrothal period. Could Mary have been stoned? Isn't that interesting, the tie-ins? Yeah. That's why they're saying, who's your daddy? Where's your daddy? And that is, it's mean. Also, this also leads us to believe that Joseph is dead by this point. He's never mentioned anywhere else. Anytime Jesus goes anywhere, Joseph's not mentioned. Mary's all over the place. So we think that Joseph died. But they know there's some weird things about your birth, and I don't know if I like it. I think there was some stuff going on. So they're like, who is your father? Where is he? You don't know me or my father, Jesus replied. If you knew me, you would know my father also. And he's not talking about Joseph. He spoke these words while teaching in the temple area near the place where the offerings were put. That's how it links it together with the Feast of Tabernacles. It happened in the court of the women, which is where any Jewish person could go into the court of women. You had to be a Jew, and then you could have the celebration. That's where the offerings were done. That's where the bowls and the lights were lit. So that's how we link that all together. Amazing. Yet no one seized him because his time had not yet come. I don't know what that means. Again, I think it's slow motion. And then Jesus is like, excuse me, I'll just move over here. And it's funny because Jesus doesn't bolt the scene. What does Jesus do? He sticks around for another whole chapter. I love this. I could just see him, they're just about ready to grab him, and all of a sudden he's like over there. Whoa, hey, I don't know. Okay. Once more, Jesus said to them, I am going away and you will look for me and you will die in your sin. Where I go, you cannot come. Oh. Don't use this as a witnessing technique, by the way. Because you ain't God. Right? Yeah. Don't go up to someone and say, you're going to die in your sin. But isn't this an interesting contrast to the story of the woman? You see, I mean, that's that delicate balance we've got. Here's a woman. She's dead to rights. Now he's speaking to pastors. They're going to die in their sin. Ooh. You let Jesus handle that. That's the reason why he says, don't judge anyone's salvation. It's not a good idea. Jesus can do it and can get away with it. Now, that's a chilling statement. Do they still have the opportunity? The gift is still available, but he knows full well they're not going to take advantage of it. That has got to be one of the... Yeah. Yeah, he's talking to certain people that he knows. Yeah, he's not putting a judgment on everyone. Again, some people use this as like all Jews are going to die in their sin. No, who were the first Christians? Jews, yeah. Who was Jesus? He was a Jew. So yeah, he's speaking to a very specific group that's trying to get to him. And he's letting them know, he's putting a judgment on their salvation because he knows. Yeah, don't let this become a thing against all. Now, you want to hear a worse verse? Worse verse? We won't get to it, but verse 31 has got to be the worst verse around. To the Jews who had believed in him. And then he spends, look at the headings, children of Abraham. Look at the next passage. Children of the devil. Oh man, it's going to get good, but that's next week. I'm moving on. I'm sorry. I just bring that up because this is the kind of stuff that you read and you're going, oh my God. Yeah, Jesus is not some nicey, oh, I love all of you and you're not going to have any problem. Yes, he does that with certain people. You know, the woman caught in adultery and the woman at the well. But man, when he needs to tell it like it is, Dr. Phil, move over. All right. So he says, where I go, you cannot come. Verse 22, this made the Jews ask, will he kill himself? They had a tradition that if you committed suicide, you were put in the deepest, darkest place of Hades where no one could find you. It's a bad theology of suicide, just so you know. I don't endorse that, okay? But that's what they thought. And so they're like, well, maybe he's going to kill himself and we're not going to be able to find him. Of course, they're making a judgment like, oh, well, we're going to heaven, so you must be going the other direction. That's their idea. Verse 23, but he continued, you are from below, I'm from above. You are from this world. I am not of this world. There's that phrase. You see the NOTWs all over. Not of this world. That's what it's talking about. I told you that you would die in your sins. If you do not believe that I am the one I claim to be, you will indeed die in your sins. There it is, plain and simple. Everyone's going to die. The question is, will you be in your sin or will your sin not be counted against you? Well, how do you get your sin not counted against you? Well, he says it. If you believe that I am he. There you go. Once again, the gospel, plain and simple, as it can get. I love verse 25. I get visions of Princess Bride. Who are you? If you know the movie, it's a great line. Who are you? That's my attempt at the accent. They asked, and he says, just what I have been claiming all along. He's like, I've told you a million times, I'll say it again. Goodness gracious. I have much to say in judgment of you, but he who sent me is reliable, and what I have heard from him I tell the world. They did not understand that he was telling them about his father. So Jesus said, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, and what is that in reference to again? Crucifixion, yeah. The same words, lifted up. What is it a reference to? Death. Who's death? Jesus. Good. We got both answers in. Perfect. When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am the one I claim to be and that I do nothing on my own, but speak just what the Father has taught me. The one who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do what pleases him. Even as he spoke, many put their faith in him. We're going to stop there, but don't stop with your life. Man, that parable is good. Sorry, it's not a parable. That story is good. Where you at? What you doing? Do you need to hear that God doesn't condemn you, but that offer is still available to you? Do you need to hear that He wants you to leave the life of sin? Do you need to hear, once again, you put down the rocks? Do you need to hear, once again, it's time to follow that light? So much here. And I pray, as I always do, that the Spirit will move you as He needs to. This is God's text and God's Word. He knows exactly where every one of you is at, and even where that one's at. Yeah, he's sad. He will comfort him, yes. And God knows where you're at and what you need, and the question is, are you going to be honest? Are you going to be honest with where you're at in life? Because that's what it's all about. Communion is a great time, I tell you. Communion is a wonderful time of receiving. And I don't know what you need to hear. I don't know what it is that's going on in your life, but communion gives us a chance for you to go to